returned a bag of groceries, accidentally taken off the shelf before the expiration date. I came back as a bag of groceries, accidentally taken off the shelf before the day stamped on my stand. Did a large procession wave their torches as my head fell in the basket. And was everybody dancing on the casket? Now it's here, I'm dead and I haven't done anything that I want. Or I'm still alive and there's nothing I want to do.
If I decide to come back, if I decide to come out of retirement, I definitely coming soon within the next 2 months. I'm going to do a Mormon funerals podcast, and Melissa, Glenn's sister, wants to be a part of it. We just got to get her a fucking mic that works.
From Agent K.
I worked the Zed for over 40 years, and in all that time, he never invited me to dinner. He never asked me to his house to watch a game. He never shared a single detail of his personal life.
I agree.
Thank you.
And now we will hear from our new chief, Agent O.
Thank you, Agent K. That was very moving.
That was your eulogy?
He was a good man. That day.
Graham Chapman, co-author of The Parrot Sketch, is no more. He has ceased to be. Bereft of life, he rests in peace. He's kicked the bucket, hopped the twig, bit the dust, snuffed it, breathed his last, and gone to meet the great head of light entertainment in the sky. And I guess that we're all thinking how sad it is that a man of such talent, of such capability, the kindness, of such unusual intelligence, should now so suddenly be spirited away at the age of only 48, before he'd achieved many of the things of which he was capable, and before he'd had enough fun. Well, I feel that I should say nonsense. Good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard, I hope he's trying. And the reason I feel I should say this is he would never forgive me if I didn't, if I threw away this glorious opportunity to shock you all on his behalf. Anything for him but mindless good taste. I could hear him whispering in my ear last night as I was writing this, "All right, please," he was saying, "you're very proud of being the very first person ever to say shit on British television. If this service is really for me, just for starters, I want you to become the first person ever at a British memorial service to say fuck."
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
Hello. Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I am Stephen Hawking, the real Stephen Hawking. And today is going to be a sad discussion. A very sad discussion. Because today is all about death and funerals. And a little bit about wedding receptions held in Mormon cultural halls. See? Very, very sad. So with no further fucking ado, let's fucking turn it over to fucking Randy Snyder.
I was gonna say, so he kills himself. Did you go...
And his fucking amazing panel of Allison.
You're not denying death, because it's not really death.
And Melissa.
I mean, it's always sad. Of course it's sad. It's horrible.
And Melissa's brother, Glenn.
With God, nothing is impossible, but some things are just really, really hard.
And Greg, who developed the new infant's logo and sometimes even says stuff.
No pun intended.
So with no further fucking ado, take it fucking away, Randy.
We don't do the introductions, right? So,
Let's talk about death, baby.
We're about to put the fun in funerals.
My projects always seem to be the most depressing. Happiness. Funerals.
Happiness is a very depressing.
Depression. I'm a Debbie Downer. What can I say? But the reason why this has been a subject that's has been on my mind for the last few years is I experienced a significant funeral as a believer, which was my mom when I was 21. And then I experienced, not as significant, but pretty damn significant. My first cousin died, and it's not just like my first cousin died. She was like this beautiful person that everyone loved. She was an amazing person that had three little girls. Like, they were ages 3, 5, and 7. So, and then left an adoring husband, all in her mid-30s, right after my faith crisis. So I went to the funeral, and the experience was so different, and it was so weird how this, like, I'm a train wreck at the whole funeral, and I know the husband had probably been, you know, she'd been dying of cancer, so he's probably spent all his tears, but her sister that gave a talk without choking up once, people looking at me like, why, what, you know, pull yourself together, man. And it just, all of a sudden, I felt like I had been thrust into this bizarro world where people were in such denial of what was going on that it just creeped me the fuck out. And the question I've always, or not, that this has always brought into my mind is this a bad thing or is this a good thing? And I don't really know. And that's kind of what I want to explore about Mormon funerals is, and I want to explore other aspects of Mormons and death, but that's kind of the genesis of me, you know, pushing to have this happen.
So are you asking if the denial of death is a good thing or a bad thing? That's what you're...
Yeah. I'm wondering if it not just a good or bad thing, but also is it a healthy thing? Is it a psychologically healthy thing?
Is it even denial?
What do you mean by that?
Okay, my theory is that Mormons spend so much time preparing for death by going to the temple. Because the endowment ceremony is like, it's going through the veil. And even though it's not explicitly talking about death, that's what it is, because it's just seen as, you know, going into the next life.
Yeah. And then you like go into the celestial room and you see everybody there, right?
Yeah. And it's all happy.
Yeah. Right.
So it's denial, but it's like only denial if you think about it as them dying. But if you think about as them, as your loved one's going on into the next life, just passing through the veil, then you're not denying death because it's not really death.
They're not really gone.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
It's just, they've just gone somewhere else and you'll see them again.
What's being denied? Is it like
the finality? The finality of death.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because in their eyes, it's not.
At all. Right. I imagine my mom, like, I really believe now sitting, you know, where the family sits in the first two rows. I just remember looking over there going, I know she's sitting on that casket watching this. I just know it. Like, she's not really there. No, but she's a hunk of meat inside that wooden box. That's the reality of the situation. But I, you know, it was soothing, for, for me to see it in a way where death isn't really death. It's not really final. It's not really over. But when I was, you know, went to my cousin's funeral as an atheist, it was profoundly sad. And I don't have any, I couldn't find anything on psychological theories of, you know, whether or not finding some way to deny death to some degree is a healthy thing, or if just having the raw mourning and feeling this true sadness of the situation, whether that's more healthy, whether that is cathartic and helps you move on better. And I don't know.
Sure. I mean, I could share just a little anecdote, I guess, of an experience that I had that kind of, you made me think of it when you were talking about going to your cousin's wedding after you had already moved on from Mormonism. And so you kind of saw it under those different eyes. And my experience with that is just, we lost Greg's brother a couple years ago, and nobody knew that we had intellectually moved on from the church. Like, we hadn't really voiced it. It had been something that we had been struggling with for a long time in quiet. And for me, it was kind of one of those like truth moments, like, okay, well now here we are faced with like a really major situation that before my theology would have been a huge comfort. And so do I still really not believe that Mormon church is true? And like this whole family is our forever. Like that's such a better idea of dealing with such a loss and, you know, processing those thoughts than thinking, no, I really just think he's gone, you know? And so anyways, for me, it was just kind of one of those moments where I realized, oh yeah, I really kind of have moved on from these. And for me, it wasn't quite, I mean, it's always sad. Of course it's sad. It's horrible. But it made me kind of think more of the life that he had lived rather than just being like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter because we're going to see them again anyways. It's like, no, everything he did here mattered, and the person that he was mattered, you know?
Hello, this is Stephen Hawking again. So what do you think of the discussion so far? Really super sad, huh? There were some technical difficulties here in the audio, so I am simply filling the gap of what would otherwise be an awkward transition. I think that is why the infants hired me. So Randy is about to ask Glenn about the suicide of his crippled boyhood friend. Did you know that Glenn's best friend in his teenage years was in a wheelchair? That just warms my heart. Sacrificing all the time he could have spent running and scampering around with normal kids. I bet they played a lot of chess, and checkers, and Othello. What a guy. So let's hear this story. Shall we?
So Glenn, your buddy that you'd kind of become, you guys have kind of gone your own ways, and I don't want to say the word estranged.
No, I mean we grew up together.
Just
we
were lost touch.
Yeah, we were like really close friends from about age 11 to maybe, you know, 18 when I went off to BYU, and you know, then we still kept in touch after my mission and stuff. But I, you know, I was living in Indiana and he was living in Arizona, and so we'd get together whenever I'd come home to visit. But
it was pre Facebook too.
And the other thing was he married my ex girlfriend, and so like he told me once. I remember I was on my mission and he said, I know how you are, Glenn. You like these teasing inside joke things, and I can't allow that, you know, like that you're saying little things that are little teasy things that I know, you know. So he drew these boundaries because of that relationship. And so that was a part of the estrangement as well. It was just when I would get together with them, if it was with both of them, it was a little awkward for a while. So then I don't know.
So
go ahead.
I was going to say, so he kills himself. Did you go?
Sure. Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. Did you go to the funeral?
Yeah. The family asked me to speak at it. Yeah. Well, why don't you just tell it?
No, okay, so the question I have...
You need to back up and, like, Glenn, like, ease into that a little more. You're so funny. You're always like, so John Hamer, you're gay.
What's that like? What's that all about?
Gotta caress it a bit, man.
That was a really good point that Melissa just made. She sounds like a very intelligent girl. It's hard to believe she's a blonde.
This is my question, and I'll shut up and let you go. The only reason I was like, said, oh, no, you spoke at it and interrupted, was like, oh, now I remember you saying that in your little mini-sode, which was when it was awesome. Anyway.
Insert Chris Farley. You're right, yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah. That was awesome.
Remember that one time when you spoke at that guy's funeral? Yeah.
So, were you there? Yeah, Randy, I was. I was there.
Didn't that win some awards?
No, it didn't.
Stupid,
it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What can I remember?
It's all right. So you're doing all right. You're doing fine.
What aspect? did everyone know it was a suicide? Was it like an obvious, like, there was no question he killed himself? I mean, was it common knowledge of the people you think that were at the funeral?
That's a good question. I don't know. With the small group of friends that I was with, they all knew, but common knowledge, I know the family was not advertising it, you know, so they were trying to keep it on the down low. How successful they were, I don't know. But we didn't, no one talked about it in the, you know, there were three talks. I was one, there was a family friend that was one, and then the bishop was another. And I don't think anybody mentioned anything that was even close to that.
Yeah, the reason why I'm curious is because I've never been to a Mormon funeral where somebody obviously killed themselves. I've heard about them, but I'm just wondering what
it wasn't. What, I don't know. It wasn't a typical funeral anyway. But get out your question. Go ahead.
Also, was he endowed?
He got bald and big church bells.
Was he buried in temple clothes?
It was a closed casket. So I don't know if the family did. He wasn't active, you know, he hadn't been active for a while, and the ward that the funeral was held in, the bishop didn't know who he was. No, nobody in the ward really knew who he was. It was at the wish of his mother that, they hold a Mormon funeral and they do it in that ward building. So I don't know that you can really look at it as a typical suicide Mormon funeral to draw any parallels from it. But the thing that I got out of it was the callousness of the bishop, who used it as a missionary opportunity for all of Kevin's friends that weren't members of the church. And there were a lot there. And you know, so I'm not sure if the bishop even knew that it was suicide because of some of the things that he said. And I don't know. I mean, it was, how long ago was it, Missy? It was about 10 years ago.
It was at least 11 or 12 years ago, because it was before we lived in Kansas City, and I don't think I even.
Yeah.
I know I was married, but I don't think I'd had Brody yet. But I mean, obviously, at that time, I was a true believer too, and you know, I went and was there with Glenn and his little sister. Kevin's little sister was one of my best friends, and so I was still really close with their family, even though you know Kevin's 10 years older than I am, like Glenn is. But even as a true believer and, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid of the Mormon church, I remember being so uncomfortable there as well because of kind of like what Glenn was saying, where it felt like these people don't even know him. You know, it's like there's this script of how like the Mormon funeral is supposed to be and who's supposed to be in charge. And it was very much like a church service and very preachy and not very personable at all. Like, I remember feeling really sad and uncomfortable.
Come on, mine was very personable, and so was Billy's.
Okay, that's true. That's
two
true.
Out of, you're, two you're, out of you're, three were pretty personable.
Okay, I guess that is true, but maybe the one, the rotten egg, just stunk with me the whole rest of the time.
And then, Glenn, you were saying how the bishop at this funeral, and I remember this with my mom's funeral, was it just was so weird, even as a believer, because my mom's funeral, she impacted so many lives. Like I couldn't even hope to have a funeral like this. It was like a state conference where they had to open up the basketball court behind and set up chairs back there, and they filled up. But I knew how many non-members were in the audience, and I was always uncomfortable being Mormon anyway. It was when I gave my farewell talk, couldn't believe it. Seven of my non-member friends and their parents showed up, and I had to give a talk. And I just was like, oh, how do I talk to them? They won't understand any of this. This is kind of embarrassing. But I remember there was a really good eulogy given by my mom's best friend. The second counselor in the stake presidency was commissioned to give the official talk. And I think that's the talk that Glenn, your bishop, gave.
Yeah.
Is you are mandated at a Mormon funeral to have an LDS plan of salvation talk.
And that's exactly what it was. And, you know, like my disgust with the way that went down, it's kind of like the way that when someone's grieving, another person will naively say something that is inappropriate, you know, but they don't mean to, but it's just like they're being clumsy. And I think in this bishop's case, he was talking about the different degrees of glory that you can attain to, but there was this underlying current, because Kevin had committed suicide, that it was like an unpardonable sin and he couldn't be forgiven. Or he said something like the importance of not procrastinating the day of your repentance. That's what it was. It was
right.
That Alma thing that don't procrastinate. That's... It was the worst possible thing. You know, it's like that you don't want to die in your sins. And so it was like a message.
That's passive aggressive.
Well, here's what it is.
Shitting on the dead.
But it's that naivety, because where his mind is, is on the affirming hope that the atonement can give to people, not the way that this is condemning everybody who doesn't accept that. You know, it's it was just naive. It wasn't sensitive to other perspectives, and but I'm not ascribing any malicious motive to him or anything. I think it's just because his mind was in a completely different place. He really couldn't empathize with these non-members, because to him it was really important to affirm the truthfulness of the gospel and the power of the atonement to save us. And gee, that's a great message, right? Well, there's another side of that coin. He wasn't looking at that or thinking about it. So,
well, one thing I can say is that as bad as Mormon funerals can be, they are nothing compared to Jehovah's Witness funerals.
What are those like?
Oh, so when I was on my mission, I came across this. We tracked it into this girl, and she was wearing a bikini and a towel.
Oh, that's horrible!
She was smoking hot, and her name—I never forgot her name. Her name was Matea, and she invited us in, and I was the trainer for my greenie. It's like, oh, okay. He walks right in, and I have to like reach, put the arm out in front of him. No, we can't come in. We got to come back with a third priesthood member. So we come back and we teach a first lesson that I thought went really well, but mostly it's because I just wanted to be around her.
You had a priesthood member for her.
So in between the first, and we had scheduled a second discussion, she canceled. And then I desperately tried to get a hold of her again. And then she finally returned. I don't know. I probably left like two messages. She finally returned my call and said, I don't know if you've heard on the news, but there was a girl who they found her body in the desert. She was abducted, raped, murdered, and left in the Arizona desert. And she happened to be a young Jehovah's Witness girl, like 17 or 18 years old. And this Matea was her best friend. And so her life got, turned upside down between the first and second discussion. And then I got transferred, and who knows what happened. But
did she ever put anything on over the bikini, or?
We didn't go in, dude. We came back, and she was a little bit more dressed the second time.
I'm just trying to figure out how the bikini comes into the funeral story.
I had to explain how I found out about the Jehovah's Witness funeral. But so
I see.
When I called her, because I didn't go to it, but I don't know, actually, we went by the house, and she told the story, And she said, we went to the funeral, and she's Jehovah's Witness. And there was like 700 people there.
Wait, so you didn't go to this horrible funeral, but you're
no, but I've asked Jehovah's Witnesses after since if this is how they run the funeral. She said they didn't even give a eulogy. They barely even mentioned her name, and the whole time it was a guy preaching about Jehovah's Witness and those who don't join are facing annihilation. It was, she said, it was all of her friends were so furious. And Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, they don't celebrate birthdays because that celebrate, you know, you can't overly celebrate yourself. It makes total sense that they wouldn't eulogize the dead and turn it into just a proselyting. You know, they're every bit as, if not more, proselytory than Mormons are. So if anyone who's listening has to go to a Jehovah's Witness funeral, just know what you're in store for.
Or maybe, like, tell us what it's really like if you've actually been.
Well, shut the fuck up.
I wanted to share something you made me think of. So,
Well, before you do, I just want to speculate.
Some more?
Ass. All podcasts, just to get Glenn's goat.
Oh, well, let's just draw conclusions from one anecdotal story and say this is how all Jehovah's Witness funerals are. We get, like, that's completely different than just. Or is that a version of speculation?
Go ahead, Melissa.
Okay, sorry, skipping. I have like two thoughts, but I don't know which way to go. I'm going to go with the one side. So going back to the funeral that we attended for my brother-in-law, and we were intellectually out of the church, but nobody else really knew it. And his brother had been inactive for a number of years. And I can't tell you how many people came up to us and said, well, maybe this will help his family to come back to the church after dealing with this, you know, and wanting to be together again forever. And of course they don't know who they're talking to because they don't realize that we don't subscribe to Mormonism anymore either. But just the fact that that was like a piece of their comfort, like, oh, it's almost like a wake up call from God to the rest of his family to like, you better get back on the Mormon train because, you know, otherwise you're never going to be able to be together again. Just, it's horrible. Just that mindset.
Yeah, I think that's pretty common. I've heard that a lot, especially with not a lot. I'm going to say twice, Glenn. I don't know if that doesn't count as a lot, but yeah, that it's God's way of, you know, helping people get on back on track.
Right, it's somehow, like the one man perish kind of things, yeah, rather than a whole family dwindle or just
exactly.
Like, it was so inappropriate. And of course we didn't really say anything. I just kind of looked at them. I'm like, you know what? I think they're really good people. They're going to figure it out.
Yeah. But I wonder if you are mourning and you hear that and you are a believer, but you have, you know, gotten away from the church or become inactive. If you hear that, are you going to be offended? Or are you going to go, huh? You know, maybe so. Like, is it only offensive to us because of the position we're in? I guess is what I'm asking.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wasn't listening to anything Melissa said because I was looking up Jehovah's Witness funeral.
Awesome.
Oh, thank you.
But anyway,
it's not like that was like a pivotal point in my life or anything that I just shared. So,
cool. Were you talking about like some of the things that people say to try to make the bereaved feel better, or did I not catch?
Yes. Okay. Yes, that was part of it.
Yeah.
Specifically saying that, you know, maybe his death will help his family come back to the church, not knowing that we had also left. But
yeah, okay, that's pretty funny. But
could have used you like 5 seconds ago, Randy.
I know. I explained why I wasn't listening. Anyway, that's something I learned when my mom died was that, even if you're a believer, like trying to ascribe some trite meaning to her death when I just want to feel like, I just want to feel pain. It doesn't help, you know, the only thing you can say, the only thing to say is an expression of your love and sorrow. Love for you and sorrow for what happened to you. That's the only thing that you can say when somebody don't try to come up with something profound.
The Lord really needs them.
Oh, they're doing missionary work now. And you know, like when people would say, you know, your mother was wanting, you know, was needed more on the other side. Well, my 14-year-old sister needed her pretty bad, and I even knew that as a believer. So that kind of triteness just is counterproductive. And I know my mom. I know for a fact my mom. I have the most disgustingly horrific tape. My mom got into a lot of pseudoscience before she died because she basically was left for dead, you know, by traditional medicine. And so she started to look into homeopathic remedies, going all the way to Mexico to get it. She was reading books on the power of positive thinking. And so part of the protocol for this book was record yourself saying all the things you want to live for. If you're terminal, and then listen to it while you go to sleep, and that will imbue your mind with so much positive power. And I, after she had died, I came across that tape and I put it in. Back then it was put it in my little Walkman, and just listened to her pleading that she wants to see my wedding. She wants to see Jeff go on his mission. She wants to see Kelly graduate from high school, and just bawling and crying and pleading and pleading. My mom wanted to stay. So for someone then to come to me after I'd experienced that and say, well, you know, she was needed more somewhere else, just made me want to punch people in the face. So tip, just show love and empathy. That's all you can say.
I think that's good advice. I haven't, as of yet, been really, really close to anybody who's passed away. Just had grandparents and acquaintances and stuff. And I think in that position, I've said stupid things because I don't know what else to say. You know, because grief is really uncomfortable to deal with. And other people grieving is really uncomfortable. And I think people say that kind of stuff more so to comfort themselves.
Right.
Like the idea of, what if this happened to me and I would want to think this, so I'm just going to say it. Not understanding that they have no idea what you're going through. They can't imagine it. They can think they can, but they don't. They don't understand it. So I would say too, like if somebody says that to you, never mind, I'm not going to go there. You need to grieve. If you feel like punching somebody in the face, that's how you're going to feel. And you have the right to feel that way. I really think that. I mean, I wouldn't punch him, Randy, but...
No, and really, it's coming from a good place.
Right.
They're not being malicious in any way. They're trying to... And they really want to, like, somehow, if it's possible, to extract a little portion of your pain away. But then they do it in a way not understanding all the dynamics and the emotions that comes with experiencing such an acute, tragic loss, that, you know, you end up stumbling over yourself and adding to the pain, mm-hmm. You know, when you're just trying to help, so I don't want people to think that I'm thinking that these people are assholes about it. It's just, there's nothing to say. There's nothing you can do. When I first left the church, I actually had a real fear, because this is like right after I left the church. I was like,
more real than spiders.
More real, because the spiders are all in my head. At least the ones that attacked me in the middle of the night. Was dying like quickly after that and being buried in Mormon funeral clothes. I never, until my mom died, I guess I hadn't paid attention, or maybe I was too young at my, you know, grandpa's funeral. I hadn't realized how funny the clothes were. I mean, these are clothes that are, you know, behind granite walls that are hidden from the world until the internet, but they're hidden from the world. But then somehow in the funeral, they're out on display for everyone to see. Something weird about that.
Yeah, there must be a lot of questions from people. I was kind of the same way. Anytime I went to a funeral, I just never even noticed that they were wearing temple clothes.
Yeah, well, I guess with the women, they're wearing a veil, so that looks less ridiculous than the baker's hat.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't put all that on until right before they close the casket.
Is that?
Yeah, so you probably really never even noticed it, because they'll just be in their temple whites or whatever, and then, like, the family comes up and does the rest of it, and they close the casket.
Yeah, you're right.
So typically they're just wearing the white pants, white shirt kind of thing.
Right, or like a white dress, and they just look peaceful.
I thought I'd seen one where someone was in, like, full-on priesthood robes and apron and everything.
Hmm. Now, that was a video you probably watched on YouTube.
Yeah. The reason why my mom's funeral was the first time I noticed it, because it happens in the Relief Society room just when the family, only the closest family members are allowed in for a prayer. And then they shut the casket.
Right.
But before they shut the casket, that's when they adorn them with all of the accessories, which would be the baker's hat or the veil and the apron, the sash, whatever. All right, so
that was one thing that I really liked about the situation with Greg's brother, even though it did still end up being a Mormon funeral, which I really don't think he would have liked. But his wife was super cool, and she was just kind of like, whatever makes his family feel better. But he was buried in his bright yellow Wranglers button-down shirt that he loved, with his boots and his chew right in his front pocket.
His shoe in his front pocket. Nice.
He would have liked that. And he had been endowed. I mean, like I said, he hadn't been active for years, but that part was cool.
So is it somewhere in the handbook of instructions that says that we're not allowed to cremate the remains of a faithful Latter-day Saint? Where does that come from? Is it in Doctrine and Covenants?
Well, all I've heard is that in the handbook it says that it's not recommended, kind of like how, vasectomies are not recommended, but it's up to the person. But I don't know if that's true. It's just what I've heard people say.
Yeah, but for some reason, when I was a believer, it made sense that, like, I know we all have to, we're going to die and our bodies aren't going to be completely perfect anyways, like being buried and decomposing in the ground. But, like, you got to have something to work with to be able to restore it, right? So if you totally burn everything, that's just too much for God to handle. I mean, there's all those people, the morning of the first resurrection anyway, right? So
yeah, the way
better like help them out, so then you still have like half a body.
Well, what I remember being taught was that the priesthood holder, in the morning of the first resurrection, the priesthood holder is the first to get resurrected. And the reason why is so that he can then stand over the wife of his grave and raise her from the dead using the priesthood and pull her out of the grave. And what was that?
Sorry, I just wanted to ask a question, and maybe this is so obvious and I'm just missing the boat, but like, going back to the temple part and like how you have a special name and your husband knows the wife's name, but like the wife's not allowed to know the husband name. Who knows the husband name? Is that just like God himself? And so God calls you forward and then you then call like your wife forward?
Yeah, it kind of goes along the same pattern of when you're in the temple, the man covenants to God. Okay. So that, the man gets to deal with God directly. And then the woman covenants to the husband as far as the husband is faithful to God. So it's kind of that chain of command thing. The women are below the men in the chain of command. And they used to be even like stronger language before 1990. And they changed the language to make it a little bit softer. Like instead of like, you must be obedient to your husband as he is obedient to the Father, it was like, you must hearken unto the counsel of your husband as he hearkens unto the counsel of the Father. And that was a little change they made, probably as a result of a response to the feminist movement during the ERA crisis.
Yeah. Did you guys ever hear the story about the Utah farmer that was out like tilling his land and he hit some unmarked Indian grave, and all of a sudden this little Indian girl, like, resurrected right in front of his eyes and then, like, beamed up into the sky. And the explanation was that this was, like, a Nephite grave that had been dedicated by the priesthood, you know, in Nephite days to resurrect. And, like, the trigger, or the farmer triggered it by, like, disturbing it or something.
What is that?
Did you guys hear like that? Am I the only one?
No.
You never heard that?
No, never heard that.
Never heard that.
Yeah.
Makes sense, though, when you think about it.
Sure, but, yeah, right. Of course.
So how did he trigger it?
Her name was, like, Tilla or something like that. He was like, I'm going to Tilla the ground. And it, like, just popped up. He said the magic word.
No, but it just disturbed.
You have to say something that – you just disturbed it and it triggered it?
It was some – I think the story was that the girl had been blessed that if it was ever disturbed, it would be resurrected or something. And maybe – see, now I'm making up details, okay? But
wait, it's got to be your bowl.
Yeah, it was because the Lamanites were cannibals at a certain time in the Book of Mormon. And so to protect the grave-robbing cannibal Lamanites, you know, we put this protective spell on his daughter. I don't know. But I remember hearing that story – you know, probably I was in high school, maybe I was at BYU, and then later on I found it in the folklore archives, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. There are different versions of it, but I don't know. I'd be interested if some of our listeners have heard it. I'm sure some have, but
yeah. So I don't. If that's the belief that, you know, I think it was Melissa said, there's got to be at least some part of your body
right.
that's preserved for the priest. You know, it's almost like Voldemort getting resurrected. He needed the bone of his father. He needed the, you know, unwillingly taken, the flesh of the servant willingly sacrificed. And if you don't have like a strand of DNA to work with, I guess the priesthood ordinance can't be performed.
Well, yeah. And what about people that are just like, they were burned alive, or, you know, they don't even exist at all.
Right, like plane crash victims where they evaporate.
Well, it's important to remember that with God, nothing is impossible, but some things are just really, really hard.
Right. Inconvenience him. I mean, he's got a lot to do.
When you can throw him a bone.
So
that always bothered me that when I joined the church that being cremated was kind of a no-no, because I always wanted to – it's been a dream of mine to be cremated. I've always thought, you know, that's how I'm going to go, and I didn't see the problem with it. I thought it was weird that you had to be buried if you were Mormon, so I don't know. I was just going to break the rules when I died. But.
Were you planning on being cremated? I mean,
well, yeah.
You were so young, you probably weren't thinking about death, but, or were you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm pretty morbid. No, it's something I thought of, and I talked to my husband and my family about it. Like, I know that the church, you know, doesn't really, that they kind of frown on this, but I do want to be cremated. So that's
how you. Did you happen to listen to that podcast I suggested to you guys?
No.
Allison, I'd be curious if you feel the same way after you listen to it. So for everybody listening, I'll just throw it out there because I thought it was hilarious. I listened to it a little bit more today.
I don't anymore. Even without listening to it, I don't. I've changed my mind.
Oh, you have?
Yes, okay. But go ahead and...
Well, we'll have to talk about that at the end. But anyways, yeah, the podcast is Moshe Kasher is the comedian, and he does a monthly thing with a live audience, and it's Hound Tall, and he did a discussion on death. It was really interesting. And he talks with somebody who used to work at a crematorium. So, but
it's pretty gnarly. They like burn you and then they have to grind up all your big bones in a big grinder machine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it actually creates like a ton of carbon emissions. It's really bad for the environment.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you want a green funeral.
I would like a green funeral, or there's this new thing that they actually use for livestock. They've been using it for livestock for a really long time, but you basically get dissolved in lye and then you just turn into a powder, and it's like a big water bath and there's lye and you get dissolved and then they drain it out and what's left is a powder, and it's really clean and easy and cheap. Doesn't hurt anybody. And it's
that
weird.
Like the plan for me.
And people, it's unsettling. to, you know, if you never heard of that before, and you know that that's how they do it with livestock. Sounds appealing. Not really. But either that or there's like these pods that you can be put into, kind of like the movie The Island. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
Where they grow people in these like weird pod things. Well, anyway.
Neo, what's the...
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
And so they can put you in a pod and then plant you and you grow a tree.
Yeah. That's cool.
Aww.
Becoming a diamond. Cool, you can like be pressured into a tree.
Yes.
It's poetic.
I'm going to be a diamond or a tree.
You could be both.
I will be a diamond tree. Like
like your arm could be a diamond.
Right. So this was something that we're kind of like heading there, but I wrote this down just as I was thinking of like death and funerals and stuff. Did you guys ever think, okay, so I'll just back up a little bit. I had my driver's license out just the other day and my son was looking at it and he's like, what does organ donor mean? And so I explained that to him. Like, did you guys ever think when you were Mormon, like, I will be the best damn organ donor ever because I am so pure and my organs are just like ripe to give to somebody else. Like I don't drink coffee. I don't smoke. Like,
oh, that's what you meant by pure. I thought you meant that your spirit was so pure that your organs somehow performed better.
Yeah, no, I just, the years of clean living. Like I definitely had like a little chip on my shoulder of like, you're welcome. Whoever gets this next. Nobody?
I totally thought that. Totally. I was like, I'm going to be first choice for a heart transplant when I die. Somebody's going to totally want my heart and my liver squeaky clean.
Right?
Yeah, yes. Not anymore.
I got cirrhosis, I'm sure, by now. some forms or some level of cirrhosis. But one other thing I wanted to talk about, unless we want to keep going in this direction, does anyone else have any more to say about different ways to be buried?
Super morbid, gross part that I actually find really interesting.
Well, my form of death denial isn't believing that I live on forever in some other form of like a spirit. It's like I almost want to do what Ted Williams did and be cryonically frozen. And just in case, for the, you know, 1/1,000,000,000th of a chance that someone will develop technology that they'll be able to resurrect me. That's my death denial.
I watched this video in my death and dying class that I'd take in college, and this guy had his wife cremated and turned into capsules, and he ate one every day. So he felt like she was like becoming him, and that's how she was going to live on, and then he was going to be cryogenically frozen.
It's cryonically.
Is it cryonically? Okay, yeah. But what if I like how cryogenically sounds better? Can I still
cryogenics?
Say it?
Yeah, that's a field of science, but cryonic. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm gonna keep saying it that way.
Is why we're gonna need another Randy in 200,000 years.
Yeah, but anyway, he was gonna get himself frozen like Ted Williams and Randy, and then he would come back to life when they figured out. I think it's a good plan.
Wait, but I still don't understand the eating his wife thing.
I know. <That's>
beyond my comprehension, I guess.
I was pretty messed up.
So
but you took a class on death?
Oh yeah, death and dying. Even if they offer it like at a local community college and it's cheap, you should take it. I recommend that to everyone. It's fascinating, and you have to put together your end of life plan. For most classes, you have to do something like that where you know, do you have a DNR? Do you have what's your plan? If you need a feeding tube, you know, what do you want? And so I have a whole like binder full of stuff that I want for me, for my end of life. And it also just gets you really comfortable with the idea of death. And we get to tour a funeral home. They didn't let us see any of the really gnarly stuff. Yes, I think it's fascinating. This is the stuff I think is really interesting. And it was such the sales pitch. Like the funeral home was like, you could tell that so much of their revenue comes from selling coffins and selling plots and turning people into diamonds. And it was just really, really interesting. And I wanted to see the fridge and the, you know, where they put the makeup on people. And no, we weren't allowed to see any of that. We got to see the chapel.
I was so mad when I was in dental school. They had a class as an elective. It's called forensic dentistry. And, you know, forensic dentistry is actually an important part of homicides because sometimes that's the best way to identify the victim. And they actually got to go watch an autopsy at L.A. County coroner's office. I was so mad because the reason why I didn't get into the class was I had forgotten to sign up on the day we signed up for electives. I totally spaced it. And then the guys that got to go see it, I was so jealous. But since we're going down the morbid track, do you guys know that there's a farm somewhere in the South where a scientist, he's an actual professor at one of the universities, studies how bodies decompose? He's got the body farm. And he's got bodies that are they're freshly dead, and he'll stick them in the back of a car in the middle of summer just to see how long it'll take to decompose. Or he'll stick a body out in the open to see what kind of insects at what stages infest the body. Can you imagine a job like that?
How long does it take a body to decompose? Because that always seemed like a weak link in the Zelf the White Lamanite story.
It depends on the climate. That's first and foremost, depends on the climate. If you're in a dry, dry desert, it could take a really long time. But I listened to a Point of Inquiry interview of a mortician, and that exact question was asked of her. And she said, if you're just buried in the dirt, just you, in 30 days, you'll be bones, completely bones.
And how long does it take the bones? Do the bones last forever?
Bones last a long time because they're inorganic.
Yeah.
You know, calcium hydroxyapatite lasts a long time.
So why do we need to cryogenomically freeze things if the bones last forever?
Because the DNA inside the bones doesn't last forever. It's the marrow would have the DNA in it, not the calcified exterior.
So then couldn't you just get your DNA cryonically frozen? Excuse me, cryogenically frozen?
Right.
Cryonically frozen. I suppose they could put your, you know, just some DNA in a petri dish and freeze it. I don't know. I would want as much material as possible for them to use. Do you know where the DNA that is the most durable DNA? Like if you burn a body, where are they going to go for the DNA?
I bet you know.
Mouth.
Teeth.
Inside the teeth. That's the most protected DNA in your body from fire. So, okay. Let's
talk about funerals. I want to know if anybody's been to a funeral that you really felt like, God, that was amazing. Like that was such a great, you know, it's sad, but that was such a great tribute to that person and such a great goodbye. Because we're comparing all these, you know, these horrible Mormon funerals are so awkward and weird. Yeah. But what are we comparing them to? Like our ideal funeral that we've never actually been to? Or something we've seen on Discovery Channel? You know?
Well, it's probably the narcissist in me, but I think that the tribute that I gave to Kevin was pretty awesome.
Good one, Glenn.
Seriously. I did.
It was good. I was there.
But I've been to... Yeah. Well, go ahead.
No, because it was like it was all about him, and it got people to laugh, and it was kind of healing, and it, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I thought that it did. So, but it was the other things around it, or just that bishop thing around it.
Yeah, I think what makes it hard is just, you know, the perspective of it. Because our grandma passed away in May, and Glenn wasn't able to make it out to the funeral, but I was. And this was the first Mormon funeral that I went to as like openly ex-mo or whatever. And this is a family of like. It's a really big family and they're all super into the church and very into like, anyways, they're sweet people. But, you know, my mom's the oldest. And so we walked into the chapel first and, you know, never mind the whole, like in the room thing was so awkward. And then, yeah, whoever the priesthood leader was, it didn't really seem to totally know the family, but he was the one officiating. It just was so weird. And like, she had 8 children. And like I said, my mom was the oldest. So we were in the front row. And the tributes that they had of her life really were beautiful. I mean, the parts that it was talking about her and like she was a person who just gave of her whole heart, you know.
And were those things that like her daughters put together, like family members put together?
Yeah, so they do. They're a very musical family. There was a lot of musical numbers. You know, all the grandkids that like played violins did a violin tribute. My uncle, who's a mission president in D.C., couldn't make it out for the funeral, but they like Skyped him in or like webcammed him in. And so like I would say 75% of the service was a beautiful tribute to her and her life. But then there's that other 25% that is the plan of salvation, that is, you know, all Mormon centric, where I mean, basically the message was, you better live your life as great as this lady did, or you're never going to see her again, you know? And I was sitting front row with our other brother, who's also not in the church, with our cousin, who's not in the church, who with my mom, who for all they know is borderline. And like most of my uncles and my aunts, like couldn't make eye contact with me during the service when they were giving like those parts. And I'm sure I'm probably like projecting somewhat, but I just remember sitting there like listening to the stories of her life again were beautiful. But then I would hear them talk about like the plan of salvation, how this is the only way to get back. And it's the only way we're going to see her again. And I just kind of looked at these people who I have admired my whole life and I still care a lot about, but I was just like, huh. You still totally buy into that. Like, that's fascinating to me, you know?
Well, I made you guys watch a documentary, so I'm going to bring it in a little bit anyway. There's a theory that's called terror management theory, and they've done multiple studies. I'll just mention a couple of them. The very, very first one they did was they went into Tucson, Arizona, and they got a bunch of judges into a study. And half the judges, and the reason why they chose judges is because they figured judges have a really strong sense of their moral code and their, you know, their worldview. Otherwise, they wouldn't be decisive judges. And so half the judges were asked to read or, you know, told to read an essay on, it was like a one-page essay on death. And then the control group didn't have to read an essay. And then they asked the judges to say what fine would you give for a woman defendant accused of or found guilty of solicitation. And so the control group that didn't have to read an essay on death gave out an average fine of $50. The group that was forced to read the death essay gave an average fine of $455. So there's a huge difference. And the theory is, I won't bore you with any more of the studies, but the theory of terror management theory is that when we are reminded of our death, whether it's a subliminal unconscious reminder or something overt like a funeral, you end up retrenching deeply into your worldview because your worldview suddenly feels threatened. And so at a funeral, it makes, especially a Mormon funeral, where they have a really strong, you know, very defined vision of their worldview. When you're at a funeral, that terror management theory comes out in spades. And I think that's kind of what you're experiencing, Melissa, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I definitely think there was a lot, and that's, you know, kind of the point I was making. It felt like a lot of scare tactic, and that I mean, that's one of the main reasons why I left the church, because I don't believe in scare tactic as a motivation. But again, I think just trying to go back to what Allison was saying, like I understand that my view of things now are a little skewed, so like I could appreciate the beautiful part of it, but there was that other part that just was like, if it wasn't for that, it could have been a beautiful, and I'm sure the majority of, you know, my family who is still totally into the church thought that it was beautiful, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably.
Positive.
Well, I can only say I've been to one funeral that was definitely outside of my culture and was totally different. it was kind of an eye opener. I didn't serve on this reservation. It was up when I was in Sholo serving, but there was a reservation up in the White Mountains called the White Mountain Reservation. and a non-Mormon died. And so he was given, I think they were Apache Indians. He was given an Apache funeral. And with the Apache funeral, it's not just, you know, an hour, 2 hour service in a church where they, you know, treat it like a Sunday school meeting. It's a wake, you know, it lasts days. The body is just out there for days, and it's a big party. It's, you know, I sent you guys that TED talk of that other culture, how, you know.
Oh, they like live with the people after they've died.
That's part of it.
That was interesting.
But it's also like this, the whole community comes together.
Like Weekend at Bernie's.
It was like that.
Yeah. It was like, yeah. And they do that. Like when the person dies, they don't bury them sometimes for years. And they live in the house.
Years?
And yeah. And they'll.
You just said it took 30 days.
I'm sure they have some kind of preservation technique.
Yeah, it looks like they did.
Yeah, they look mummified. And if you mummify a body, you know, gosh, we have mummies from thousands of years ago that are still, the soft tissue is still pretty well preserved. It's amazing. But what the point I'm trying to make is that it's such a rich cultural tradition. It's such a central part of so many cultures. You know, we pay people to take care of our dead, and we're so separated from it. And then we just have this really short, relatively speaking, you know, coming together. And there's a couple of directions I can go in this. I could talk about the cultural imperialism, where the Mormon church goes into one of these countries and has some success. And then they tell these local people that when their, you know, their dad, who was the branch president, dies, you need to have a Mormon funeral and not do the, you know. Did you ever experience that in Japan, Glenn, where you had a Mormon Japanese person die? And did you go to any funerals?
Nope.
Does Japan, okay, what is Japan's cultural, how do they deal with the dead?
It's a Buddhist ceremony typically, and like Allison said earlier, with the cremation, they cremate, and then they have a formal ceremony just for really close members of the family, where they pick the bones out of the ashes with chopsticks and pass them from person to person with the chopsticks, which is one of the reasons why you never pass food from person to person with chopsticks. And you also never put your chopsticks straight up in a bowl of rice, because that's part of the funeral display as well. But I don't know if when converted, you know, to the cultural imperialism thing, I don't know if, well, I would guess that Japanese Mormons probably don't do the Buddhist ceremony, but I don't know if it would really be frowned on that much either. It depends on the person, how militant they are. Because they're able to compartmentalize the Buddhist, the Shinto, sometimes the Mormon, the Christian. I think Mormons are probably less apt to do that, but yeah, so that's what it's like in Japan.
That's cool. I don't know. But I would say this, I wouldn't be surprised if this kind of cultural imperialism does happen in a lot of different countries where, they, the local leader, especially if he's happens to be Americanized or American, would have them turn away from something that is so rich and so beautiful to then have a Mormon service that is so bland and so ordinary and uninteresting. And that would just make me sad if that happens. I hope it doesn't, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does.
I think that's the thing that makes me sad, just, you know, with the Mormon culture anyways, is it is so much of, you know, being a part of the in crowd and just doing, you know, what is protocol, I guess, so just, you know, what's already been set out is there's not really any room for personality. You know, like I remember going to a funeral back in Arizona for one of Greg's coworkers who had been battling cancer for a long time. And I didn't know her super well. But the few times I met her, I mean, of course, she's just like a wonderful person. And when she did end up passing away, I don't remember all of the details about the ceremony. I remember being hesitant because I'd never been to like a non-Mormon funeral, but it was so beautiful and it was just about her life. And then everybody who was there had, you know, the balloons. They did like the balloon release thing. And I think we actually did do that with Greg's brother too, but there's just so many things that, like, because you have to have like the certain talk and you have to have like the songs, and it does feel like a regular church service. It doesn't always leave room for personality, I guess is what I'm saying. Or, you know, like the personal touches of what you would want.
But don't, I mean, that kind of goes against what you said about Grandma's funeral and like the beautiful musical numbers and presentations that were given in tribute to her life. Like there definitely was, I mean, it sounds like to me a very personalized feel to it. I don't, you know, like anytime we're really dismissive, I just like it triggers my dismissive fight back response. So, you know, like when in my case with the Kevin funeral, they let me play a guitar and sing like a Paul McCartney song on the stand, and that's not something they typically allow in a service.
My grandfather-in-law's funeral, his one of his granddaughters played the saxophone in the chapel.
Yeah.
I think it probably just takes people saying, you know, we're going to do this because it's our funeral. And I think you're kind of right, Glenn. I don't know that it would be challenged in a lot of cases, maybe some, but people tend to be pretty sensitive when it comes to death, even Mormons.
Well, I mean, you're right. Like, it's probably just part of like that tradition is just very similar to some of the other ones, I guess.
Well, there's definitely a tendency to make it like a meeting and to have it follow certain things that are written in that make it a little bit more rigid and structured. But, you know, I think
that's what people are comfortable with.
Right, exactly. And
that's true.
And to then say, you know, that it's so like shallow and empty and meaningless, you know, it's such a subjective thing. And I think for
I didn't say meaningless. I said uninteresting and ordinary.
Oh, okay. And so
overall it is, dude. It's an hour and a half church service. Okay. Maybe you throw in a little spice of a guitar and a saxophone. It's still like a bland bowl of oatmeal that you put just a little bit of spice in.
That's subjective, Randy. And it's not going to be the same for everybody.
Yeah. Well, it's not the same if you're a believer. I mean, that's sure. That's certain. But
and that's what 95% of people that are there.
Yeah. But then, okay. What would it be like if you're an inactive Mormon going to, like, say your best friend was just a stalwart Mormon and you're inactive and you're not necessarily a non-believer.
In any culture, you're the minority. And so the culture isn't catering for you. It's catering for the majority. So, you know, I just don't want to be too dismissive and say that it's an interesting flat period stamp. I mean, I accept it.
I'm going to draw a parallel. Yeah. Mormon wedding receptions. compare that to like a Jewish wedding.
No.
Where they have tradition. they have dancing, yeah. You know, it's a celebration. Everyone's having fun. And then you go to a Mormon wedding reception.
Yeah, but
people won't want to be there for more than their own people won't want to be there for more than 15 minutes.
Right.
Well, but lack of fun does not equate to lack of tradition. It's the way it is because it's the way it is.
Well, it's not lack of tradition. It's the quality of the culture. You know, it goes back to what Melissa said. It's like conformity is rule number one in Mormonism. And so everyone has the same wedding reception. You always have the line. So you got to go through and shake people's hands you don't know. And like, hey, how you doing? So who are you related to? Okay, bye.
But isn't conformity kind of tradition? Like, isn't that kind of
what? Yeah, it's a shitty tradition. Yes.
I mean, I'm not saying that you're wrong. In your view, it's a shitty tradition. But I am saying that it's a tradition because it is. Like, that's what people do because that's what they're comfortable with. And I think it's great if you realize that you're not comfortable with it and you want to do something different. But I don't think that inherently makes their traditions boring. Like, to them, it's maybe not.
Have you been to a wedding, a Mormon wedding reception?
Like, yeah, I had one, and I've been to lots. And people at the time who are not drinking, who do not have really any sense of what it's like to go to an actual like party, if you think about it, we're having a good time.
Right.
You know, they were happy. So,
and for the amount of money that you spend on the cultural hall, it might as well be a Jewish reception. I've been waiting to say that. I don't think I delivered it quite the way that it was in my head, but yeah.
I don't know. It's consistent with just the level of worship.
Well, Randy, I think it's difficult. We really can't say no because we're out of it and we see these things. And like, I love my reception. I still am pretty happy with most of the choices that we made. Even still, I'd love to do it again now, you know, like it would be so different and such a different, you know, feel, but it's because I'm different now, you know?
You know what the best part of your reception was? The anal Tic Tacs.
What?
That wasn't the reception. That was the before.
Oh, the dinner before? Yeah. It was just a stupid little video that a friend of mine did. We had these Victor Weinstein characters.
Here to wish you and yours the very best for your wedding day nuptials. These kits are usually chock full of the latest and greatest of the Weinstein products of love. There's some real gems in here. It's like a naughty little Blammo bag. First and foremost is the famous confectionery creation, the Weinstein Hershey's French Kiss. That's right, the only candy with a burst of slobber in the middle. That's right, real tongue was too expensive, and it ruined the chocolate. Yes, that is why Weinstein technology combined with Tic Tac know-how to create the world's first anal Tic Tac. There has been some confusion about the use of the anal Tic Tac, and I am required to read the following statement. While it is true that these little bursts of freshness can also double as a breath mint, we do not recommend it. Not at all. The Weinstein anal Tic Tac comes in 5 exciting and unique aromas. You got lime. You gotta have lime. You got cinnamon, evergreen, cheddar, and tutti frutti. You gotta be careful with the cinnamon. It's a little bit potent, if you know what I mean. Kaboom. The last item, unfortunately, is no longer available. We are talking, of course, about the Weinstein Original Viagra Jell-O. While the demand for this new product skyrocketed up through the roof, unfortunately, we lost FAA approval, and there have been some less than desirable side effects reported. It stains.
Glenn had a tradition of making, of doing characters.
These ridiculous things. But, you know, another example of where we did have some creativity that we could insert some things. It didn't go over very well to most people, but it was fun for us.
Yeah, my wedding reception was awesome. My sister sang "Can You Feel the Love Tonight," and that was the extent of the entertainment. It was drab and boring.
I mean, mine wasn't great either.
Did you have Red Hots on your wedding cake? Because I may have you there.
You had Red Hots.
There were Red Hots on the wedding cake. Yeah, it was embarrassing. It was a little embarrassing
like
in the cultural
decoration?
Hall.
With
Yeah, it was like it was laced with Red Hots.
I'm surprised I don't remember that because I'm sure back then I ate a good chunk of that.
You probably had enough of it, yeah. But I mean, it was weird. It was like catered with this little Hawaiian luau kind of buffet table in the cultural hall with the folding chairs and the basketball.
The thing about the Mormon receptions that make it so awkward, and we're totally off topic from death, but it's that everybody knows
not
and you're
case.
Just waiting to go have sex, you know? That's like the worst part of the whole thing. So
that's why we left our reception early.
Yeah, right. So did we, man. We couldn't wait to get to that damn hotel room. And more than heavy pet.
Take off your clothes.
Sorry. Did you have a Mormon wedding reception, Craig?
No, we had a Mormon bishop marry us, but it wasn't Mormon.
Mm. Remember, Craig got excommunicated.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
But yeah, we had a nice reception at my folks' house.
And you probably weren't as anxious to get home.
Yeah, we already had that figured out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in Gilbert.
Okay, we're going to have to talk about that later. Anyway.
I'm just saying, this is my last thought on Mormon wedding receptions.
Yeah, we should go back to the death funeral thing.
I know, but let me just get this in. If Mormon wedding receptions are so great, time how long the average guest stays and tell me why that is.
Because they've got 10 other wedding receptions to go to that night.
Because they're not fun. They're not a celebration. They're a formality.
Sure. I agree.
But that's all they know. They don't know the other side of it that's way awesome.
Because socially, they're kind of stuck. You know, everything's appropriate. Everything's appropriate for a fifth grader. Like if a fifth grader if it's too risque for a fifth grader, they're not comfortable. So they have parties like fifth graders. And it's not that they're like retarded people. It's just socially they don't know they have not been taught or have not learned how adults have fun and have parties. And so then when they when I was a high priest group leader, I tried to throw like the biggest rager that a high priest could ever have. I had the it was at my house, so we had the pool. I had the misters going on. I had some guy cook ribs for 24 hours, and we had this awesome food, and he did the beans. And I had the because it was a young high priest group because we were in a young area. I had the Wii set up on one floor. I had PlayStation 3 set up on another floor. I had a ping pong table in the garage.
Hey, Randy.
Yeah.
Get over it.
And no, but there's a point to this.
Okay, then get there.
So the party starts at 6, and the last person leaves at like 7:55. And I you know how much work it was for that party, everyone was like, well, it's Saturday night. I got to go prepare my lesson.
They also had to go to the grocery store.
Yeah. Oh, because Saturday is a special day and you can't do it on Sunday. And so.
It may have been you.
I was one of the cool Mormons, man.
Yeah, probably.
That's a problem. Nobody else is. So,
So anyway, back to the funerals.
What was Mike's list? I feel like he had lots of other great points that maybe we didn't get to.
He didn't. He didn't.
No, we covered most of them.
Just kidding.
My one other note that I had here that didn't quite fit in when we were talking about the suicide part of things is just, you know, how it makes sense to me now why – okay, I need to rephrase this somehow. We talk so much about the next life, right? And how – like this life is preparatory for that and things are going to be so much better. So like I can almost understand why, especially as Mormons, you would consider suicide, because if things are going to be better and you're going to be like in this perfected state, I mean, I guess that's more when you're resurrected, but does anybody you catch what I'm trying to throw out there? But yeah, it's such like a, oh, but you can't because then it's giving up. It's like you're failing your test.
It's worse
than that.
It's worse than that. It's murder. And murder is in the top three of like unforgivable Mormon sins, with denying the Holy Ghost and sex. Right. It's
number two.
It's murder. It's self-murder. And so it's not like a shortcut to the celestial kingdom.
This is totally anecdotal, but I knew a family who one of their sons as a like in his early 20s. They think he killed himself. They weren't really sure what exactly happened. But they were saying to people, you know, we think that he did kill himself because he was on such a bad path in his life. He was doing drugs. He was just on the wrong path. And, like, they weren't concerned for his health and safety. They were concerned for his salvation, that kind of wrong path. And they were telling people, we do think that he committed suicide because he knew that if he kept going down this path, he would go to a much worse place than he would if he hadn't have just ended his own life. And I just thought it's interesting, but it's also horrible that they would think that or say that. But that's a different perspective. And I didn't run into that suicide is murder perspective as much as you're saying, Glenn, with Mormon people. I think that I saw a little bit more of a compassionate, you know, it's got to be a mental illness and we can't understand and God is going to understand kind of viewpoint. So
that's not my experience.
Well, that might be the way that people are responding to it. But I think doctrinally and the way that Missy was framing it was if it's so great on the other side, why don't you just make yourself go there now. It's right. Like there's a
Joseph Smith
that,
quote.
That
right?
loophole is closed doctrinally. Even though I agree with you. I mean, I think there are a lot of people that are very sympathetic of suicide, and they don't really take it, and they're not really comfortable with how harsh that doctrine is, and they go, well, God will work it out. It's not for us to judge, right?
But right.
But I think that the doctrine is there that says, no, that's not a...
Yeah, that creates a tug of war in the minds of a lot of people that surround a suicide that are Mormon, is you do have that Mormon kind of that God will work it out. Nobody understands what you're going through but God. So they do have that compassionate side, but it's also pulled really strongly by the... It's clearly outlined, Allison, that suicide is murder.
Well, yeah. I mean, you don't ever want it to seem like it's a viable option, obviously. I was thinking about that for some reason.
Well, and it's interesting because that idea that God will sort it out in the end, that's kind of always like the last resort explanation for everything, right? Like, was this temple work done right? Was every word said right? Well, you know, we do our best and then God will sort it out in the end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or this doctrine doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Oh, don't worry about it. It all makes sense in the end.
It's not pertinent.
Yeah. But, you know, the concept of the funeral being kind of like a sales pitch for the church, I mean, everybody's on the same page there, right? Like, having to face down death, it's such a powerful thing. It's so relevant to everyone's lives. It's like the perfect opportunity to just, you know, drive home that message, you know. Like Randy mentioned, the, you know, terror management theory, having those fear-based reactions, it's going to control your behavior. It's going to make you act certain ways.
Sure. Kind of like, you know, that everybody dies. It's a great equalizer. Well, we have the solution. Here it is while we're talking about it.
Yep, exactly.
So yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I do think that is something that, I will blatantly say I don't think is good and I don't like about Mormon funerals, and I don't think it needs to be part of the tradition. And you can argue with me if you want. I just think it's really callous because you're not focusing on the person anymore that died. You're not focusing on their life. You're focusing on the church.
Right. Or like I've seen a lot of things recently of I don't know. I guess it's just been interesting to me. And again, I'm looking at it with my perspective now, so it's going to be skewed. But I've had a couple of friends who have lost family members who are not Mormon. And it's a very much a tribute to their life and what their life impacted on them and how they will remember that legacy of that person. And I've seen a bit of that in some of the things that I've seen from friends who have lost church members. But it's always so-and-so died. I miss them, but I'm so glad that I know that I'm going to see them again. And I know that there's a plan of salvation. And, you know, sometimes I've even seen like, and if you need to know more about it, look into the church, you know, it, almost as far as that. Whereas it's just like, that just bothers me.
I think the first part where they say, you know, but I'm so glad, was definitely a comfort mechanism for them. But yeah, that second part, if you want to know too, well...
Right.
I don't know. Can just leave that off.
Right.
Yeah, well, and you know, that focus on the church, not the individual, I think that's another thing that's common throughout any church ceremony, any kind of ordinance. You know, it's the individual going through it, but it's all, you know, done under the purview of the church, and it's presided by the church and managed by the church. And so the focus is always on the church. It's just, you are a part of, you know, that whole.
Mm-hmm. I found my Jehovah's Witness source here. 'Cause you're talking about, I was waiting for the right segue to talk about it. Because
so did you find it?
Yeah. this is a funeral home website, and they're talking about, or they give a summary of each different kind of funeral tradition. And on their Jehovah's Witness website, it's actually very, very kind to Jehovah's Witnesses. So it's not like an attack piece.
It's just trying to explain to people why they do what they do. Jehovah's Witness service, because you're saying them, Allison, what you don't like about them is they're not as focused on the person, and they kind of turn it, because it's really kind of the closing talk, isn't it? The talk on the plan of salvation.
Yes. Yeah, usually.
So that, you know, all the stuff before is nice, and my mom's, the eulogy that was given by my mom's best friend was really good. She was a very intelligent, articulate person, and she was funny too. And actually, her sister gave a tribute to her as well, which was funny. So this is what it says: Jehovah's Witness funeral is led by one of the elders. That's one of the leaders of the local congregation. They're not led by a bishop; they're led by a group of elders. And it's seen mainly as an opportunity to preach the message of the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's 15 to 20 minutes long. That's how long a Jehovah's Witness funeral is.
Whoa.
And then they say, why does a Jehovah's Witness funeral seem less commemorative than other funerals? The answer is that believers focus on God and his calling rather than on elaborate religious ceremonies or political or worldly events. As a result, their rites, including funerals and weddings, tend to be relatively simple and based on Scripture. So it really is just a 15 to 20 minute sermon. They do, however, list their eulogy is basically reads like what are they called?
Obituary.
Yeah, it reads like an obituary where it's just a list of this is who they were, this is how they were when they died, they survived by. It's just a very short, concise. It's not commemorative, and so that's what you're going to experience at a Jehovah's Witness funeral. I'm just saying.
Yeah, so it must just absolutely suck. I'll be sure to mention that to the the J-Dub person that I work with.
How can you see that? How can you see that any other way? I mean, we're just talking. We're not talking to their face, making fun of them. We're just talking about, imagine a funeral where it's 15 to 20 minutes long. They list just facts about the person as the eulogy.
Why do they do it?
Because of their belief system.
So does it validate their belief? And does it sustain their belief system?
God damn it, Glenn. You can't have a subjective opinion, you fucking asshole.
Isn't that what I do?
You're not being subjective, Randy.
No, I'm asking him to be subjective. He's like, no, no, I am level-headed and objective, and I never say things like when I, you know, you had a whole podcast and you kept saying, I just found everything about Mormonism just so stupid. And then I'm trying to say how, like, this is just...
He is a Mormon, and so we can say that about our own selves, but it just feels odd to be saying it about something that we don't totally know
about. And Randy, I can talk about my subjective perception of things without saying that, and this is how it universally is for everybody, period, stamp. And so what I'm trying to say with the Jehovah's Witness funeral is if it's 15 minutes and if it's just business, it kind of makes sense because they don't make a big deal about birthdays. They don't celebrate Christmas. They think that all of that is frivolity and it's going to lead you away from whatever they value. And so this is something that centers on their values and it's validating to them. So yeah, we can look at it from the outside. And
that's what I'm trying to do is look at it from the outside.
We totally don't understand it. And we're judging it based on something that we have no clue about.
You can make the exact same argument for why they wouldn't want their child who was in a car accident to not get a blood transfusion because it validates their beliefs and as part of their doctrine, and it totally makes sense to them because they're following God. And I say, that's horrible. It's horrible.
Yeah. And you can say the same thing about them choosing to not vaccinate and go, yeah, it makes sense to them, but it's stupid. But that's because it has health impacts on everybody else. We're like, I don't know.
Yeah. Funeral, maybe it's not as impactful. Although that is a good question, you know, is it impactful? Does it let people grieve? If you're gonna have so little focus, let's go back to Mormon funerals, where there really isn't a lot of grieving. It's people are generally kind of either complacent or I've even been to somewhere they seem happy. You know, they're glad that they all get to be together as a family. They're so happy that they'll get to see each other again someday. And does that allow people to really grieve and accept death and then move on? You know, I don't know. If it works for you, I don't know.
I think it just depends on the circumstances. I mean, like, I'm thinking to my grandparents, you know, that was a very different situation than – you know, the ones that are more sudden. Mm-hmm. So I think that probably would play a role too, but because it is almost happy. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. you know, endure to the end. They did. Mm-hmm. Like, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You know, now they're on their next phase, and that's great, and that's happy, and that's the plan for all of us, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that works if the person was perceived by the group as someone who did endure to the end.
Right.
But it becomes awkward when it's someone that everyone knows didn't measure up. Mm-hmm. And then they have to talk about the plan of salvation, and then just kind of indirectly indict the person in the casket or anyone in the audience who doesn't feel like they measure up. And that's kind of the unintended consequence of that.
Which I think could be – oh, sorry. Go ahead, Allison.
Oh, I was just going to say that, Randy, when you talked about, you know, after you left the church and you didn't want to be buried in your temple clothes, because of that fear, I totally had that fear after I stopped going to church that I had to tell, you know, my husband, my husband's family, my family, I do not want a Mormon funeral. Do not let them
take
do
over
that to me, because – I think they will say those kind of things. I think they will say, well, you know, maybe God understood and maybe she'll be okay. Like, I don't want people saying that about me. I'm proud of how I live or how I lived. And I had a huge fear. And so I have it in writing. I will not have a Mormon funeral.
You actually got it, like went to a lawyer and
no, well, what that class that I took, I have a living will. I have a power of attorney. I have everything. I have funeral plans for myself that I had to make for the class. So yeah, it's in writing.
Now you're making me feel guilt because back in the day when the good old believing days, the one person I wanted to raise my kids with, both my wife and I died like in a plane crash at the same time, was my little brother. You know, the very, very true believing and is like militantly believing wife. Who won't let the kids even play on Sunday when the other Mormon kids in the neighborhood are playing. So I wanted him to raise my kids. And then I leave the church. And, oh, and by the way, I was going to raise his kids if both he and his wife died. And I just laziness, procrastination, I haven't done anything. And it's not something that I want to talk to him about. Because that's an awkward conversation. I'm like, hey, dude, I know you don't want me to raise your kids. And I certainly don't want you raising my kids Mormon.
You would probably understand. I don't know.
But that's something I just have to go out and do is do a living will.
You should. But, it gives you a lot of peace of mind. It really does.
But I don't know. I mean, let's say I die in 20 years, I'm 60 years old. My dad will be long gone, most likely. But my siblings are going to come to the funeral, the ones that really believe. And I just wonder how that's going to be. Like, they're going to want to get some kind of Mormonification in there.
What? But if you're dead, why does it matter? Like, because you said this earlier.
It would matter for my wife.
Okay.
I know,
well,
I'm dead.
That makes sense. But you said earlier that one of your earliest fears when you left the church is that when you died, you'd be dressed in temple clothing and like forced to have to be buried as a Mormon, even though you're not anymore. But like, it's just a hunk of flesh now. So, you know, like.
Right. Because I'm a human being I've got a brain that can conceptualize the abstract and just the feeling while I'm alive of the possibility of that happening. Makes me feel anxiety.
But it's illogical.
Now,
Spock would not be down for that. It's like highly emotional and illogical.
I think it's funny that I'm saying the exact same thing, but Glenn is picking on you.
You have to know funny? Randy's like the brother we don't have. We do have a brother, but Randy's the brother we don't have. So,
well, I can tell you why it would bother me, Glenn, is because – if, you know, to me, I want my funeral to commemorate my life. And if I no longer feel like I'm a Mormon, then I don't want that part of my life commemorated.
Well, that's why I think what you've gone and done, and, you know, having your plan, having everything written out. I mean, Randy, that's maybe it's not a fear of yours anymore. You were saying it in the past tense, but it's definitely something you can do something about. You know, you could have things written out of how, because that's what I've thought of. And that's the segue I was going to. And Allison, you just were saying the same thing I was, but, you know, it just kind of, we can say those kinds of things of how you want it, if it matters to you, you know, because I feel like again, it shouldn't matter. Logically, that makes sense. But, like, I don't want that judgment of, like, oh, too bad Missy's not Mormon anymore and she died. Like, it could have been so great. Like, she would have been in the Celestial Kingdom, you know?
Where so much was given, so little was delivered.
Right? And I just feel like I want to, like, bear my testimony that I know the church is not true, or for me, you know, like for me, I'm happy with the path that I've led and I'm not ashamed of anything. And, you know, just even when I was sitting there listening to those talks at my grandmother's funeral, and I felt so judged. And again, I'm sure I'm projecting, but I'm also sure there was some truth behind it, you know, that I'm not Mormon anymore. It's very obvious. All of our family knows, and I know they're disappointed because it works for them and it makes them happy. And so they just care. I know it's out of love, but I felt like I wanted to say, don't worry about me. Like, I'm totally fine. I know what I'm doing. I'm very conscious of the choices I'm making. I understand that you don't see them the same way, but that's okay.
So you know? when do you get to the point, and we've had this conversation before, Missy, when you recognize that you don't want to be judged by them? Like, when do you get to the point where you're like, I'm not going to judge them for their differences, and like recognize that if they do commemorate your life by celebrating the Mormon parts, that's what's of value to them, that's their way of expressing love, and you're not judging them based on it because you think it's stupid.
That's a really good point.
I know, but there's something more implicit in their judgment. Like, they're saying, you're going to have eternal consequences and torment.
But it's not true, and you believe it's not true.
I know, but it's the message is still, the sentiment is still there, and nobody wants to be a tragedy. No one wants to be looked at as a tragedy, especially when you feel like you're living a great life. This is a great way to live. But
they're looking at you that way anyway, right?
Yeah, but
and you wish that
I think it's letting
happen.
Explicitly expressed would, you know, anyway.
I think it's you don't want to let the church have the last word on your life.
Right. It's like the slumber party where you go, okay, good night. Good night. Good night. Okay. No, I'm going to be the last one to say good night. No. Okay. I'll say good night. Good night. You don't want to give them the last word. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
But still, yeah, you're dead, man.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's not an equivalency for us to say what you believe is just simply not true. And even like you said, Glenn, so stupid. That's not the same level as you are going to be damned for eternity. And boy, will you be sorry.
The implicit
message there. I said on the other side, stupid. So I was heavy handed on both sides.
But
it's not equivalent, in my opinion.
If your family gives you a Mormon funeral, they're not going to be saying Randy's going to hell forever. They're going to be saying we love Jesus because Jesus has made a way for even Randy to be redeemed.
It's going to give them comfort.
Right. They're not going to say poor Randy's going to hell. They're going to be, isn't it great that we know that there's hope even beyond? There's missionary work that goes even beyond. And it's an expression of hope. And you're painting it like they're sending you to spiritual death as well as physical death. And they aren't, you know, because that's the whole Mormon idea is that there's two types of death. There's a spiritual death and a physical death. And the spiritual death has been taken care of, man. You don't have to worry about that. The physical death, that's a bummer, but that's getting taken care of in the end too. So rejoice, shout for joy, you know, and like, so what if they say that at your funeral? I don't know. It's cool. I think it differently than you guys. That's fine. I don't care.
I think that it's just – I see what you're saying, Glenn, and funerals are for the grieving too, to help them feel better. And that definitely would, as a Mormon, help you feel better if you could say that.
They're for the grieving
I
only.
I think it's – well, no, I think they're to commemorate people's lives, in my personal opinion. That's part of the grieving process is that you are saying goodbye and you're remembering what this person did and what they were like. And so if that's not included, or if it's included in a way that is falsified because you're saying this person was Mormon,
or overly sugar-coated because that's the way they want to remember it.
Yeah. Then you're not respecting them. You're not respecting the life that they had. And yeah, no, it doesn't matter because you're dead, but everybody wants to be respected, right?
I totally agree with what you're saying. And that was one of the things that was really disconcerting to me with my friend Kevin's funeral and the way that, like, at one point his mom looked at me and said, this was Kevin's greatest friend, best friend ever. And I'm like, that's so not true. His best friend was a guy named Justin for the last 7 years of his life that wasn't a member of the church, and they did drugs and they drank, and but they were really, really close. But she refused to accept that reality. And so, yeah, I agree, Allison. I think you put it very well. It's a lack of respect to Kevin's memory, and that bothered me. So, yeah, I mean, I can see that. I can see the aversion to having that. But I think at the same time, you know, that's where they are. And because of the choices that we've made in not towing the line in the church, we know that's out there. And so we can wish that it wasn't there as much as possible, but we might as well wish that Randy had a 12-inch cock.
Well, and they're grieving now, too. You know, like our family members who are still members are grieving over the loss of us apostates now, while we're still alive.
Yeah.
And that's hard for them. So, yeah. It's just tough. But your question to Missy about, you know, when do you get to that point where you can kind of look with mutual respect in both directions?
Yeah.
Do you mean like a timeline when, or like a process when?
No, it was my way of judging her for not already being there.
No, but see, and I didn't even get a chance to answer it.
Yeah.
That's true.
But I think Allison answered it even better, and you listened to her because she's not your little sister. And you haven't had this conversation with her a bunch. But I will say, this is how I feel like I have moved past it, even if like the personal parts of it still hurt, if that makes any sense. But like, I was talking to my older son the other day, and it was this really interesting conversation that just kind of popped up organically. Like, anyways, I'll spare the details of how we got into it. But we started talking about like what happens when you die. And, you know, since we've left the church, we don't really sit down and like have lessons on any of this stuff. So I really haven't talked to him a ton. I mean, he's been around as death has happened a little bit. But I just was kind of asking him, what does he think, you know? And then I was telling him, you know, what daddy thinks. Like, daddy thinks that it's all over. And scientifically, like, I totally understand that. I see that. It makes sense. But in my mind, you know, I like to think that maybe there's still something. Like, I don't know what it is. I don't think it's like a god or in the sky or anything. But like, you know, maybe there's something. And since nobody knows for sure, we're all choosing what we want to believe. Then, you know, he can choose whatever he wants to believe that makes him feel better. But the thing is that we need to be respectful of everybody else's differing opinions, you know, and because nobody knows for sure. We're all we're all choosing what we want to believe. And so in my way, I felt like that was kind of being respectful of all of the different viewpoints of it. Does that make sense?
I can't hear the choosing to believe part now without like inside going, I'm going to let it go. Yeah.
But you know, there's a philosophical term for that. It's called doxastic involuntarism. I sent you that. Or anyway, I just to defend the asymmetry thing that Glenn wasn't buying is would you agree with me, Glenn, that to my dad, to my little brother, to my two sisters that are still in the church, I am seen as a tragedy of the first order. The magnitude of the tragedy of losing out on the celestial kingdom for a Mormon, is anything surpassed that?
Well, I'm not sure, because from what I understand, they still look at you as the same old Randy as always, and that you haven't changed.
That was my dad trying to convince my siblings.
I'm just giving you shit because I love giving you shit. I don't.
It's hard to have a conversation with you anymore.
It depends on the argument you're trying to make. What, Missy?
Said everything's always a joke with
me. Oh, right. Yeah. Everything is always a joke with me. But
yeah. Well, what I'm saying is they see me as a profound tragedy, someone like a fallen star.
It's a tragedy that you lost your faith and belief in the church and in the gospel.
Yeah. It's a true truth. Like it would have been better. Like my dad saying, you know, hey, maybe one of Kimberly's kids needs to die to wake her up and get her back in the church. It's like, where does that come from? It doesn't come from, he's not malicious. He's the sweetest guy in the world, but you know, that thought crosses his mind. And I know that, you know, I was the defender of the faith, the bridge between the non-believers and the believers, but on the believer side. And then I switched sides And, you know, when my sister says, it, you know, it was like, it was the same thing as a death in the family, how much this hurt me. That sucks. That feels really shitty. But when I look at them, it's like, you know what? They're indoctrinated. They probably are never going to see through it. But they're probably happy. That's not the same thing as seeing me as a tragedy. And it shouldn't bother me, but you know, these are the people I grew up with, people I love, and I don't want to be viewed like that. You know what? You don't have a like some 12-inch cock joke to throw out?
That's exactly what I was thinking, but I didn't say it. That's exactly what I was thinking, but I already used it. I mean, but like, so to me, it's just, you know, the understanding and the acceptance of your sister and your dad, that like when your dad says something like it might take her son dying to bring her back, that's not any kind of like wish fulfillment fantasy that the son will die so that she will come back. It's he's saying, I think she's so, her heart is so hardened and she's so numb to the spirit and the gospel message right now that it would take the worst possible tragedy that we could imagine to soften her heart. And so the worst possible tragedy that he could imagine would be the son dying. And that's how he articulates that. But I don't see that as an indictment on his belief system or how awful it is. It's his, how much he loves the gospel and loves your sister and wants her to partake of the fruit of Lehi's tree because he's Lehi and he's offering the fruit and she won't take it. So what's going to get her to not be so stubborn, you know? And it's part of the narrative thing that he's bought into, but I don't know. So it's just like understanding that's what they mean when they say that, okay, I get that. I'm not going to hold it against him. Yeah, I don't know.
I wonder if they knew that it sounded like the mafia. Like, this is a nice family you have here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
Yeah, but you can interpret it that way, but I don't think that's fair to what their intention was.
I don't think they're doing it on purpose, but you know what I mean? Like, if they stood back as an outsider and kind of viewed the conversation, would they kind of understand that.
I don't know Randy's dad at all, but I bet that if Randy called his dad out on this, he would back away from it so quickly everybody's head would be spinning and say, no, that's not what I meant. No, I don't want it that way, you know.
No, I want to be fair to him. If I had press, and I didn't because I was a believer at the time. I was young. I was only like 18 when he said that. But if I had to ask a follow-up question, I am 100% certain this is kind of about what he would say. If I said, Dad, you really want Cody to die to get Kimberly to go back to church? Oh, no, no, no. That's not what I meant. You know, because it would then bring it into the real world for him and outside of this cloud of Mormonism and Mormon doctrine into the real world of, like, that's a really – I mean, that thought should never cross your mind to manipulate your kids through one of their kids dying for God to even – be the author of that. Of course, you know?
And I mean, people say things that can be really insensitive because they're not really thinking it through from every perspective. But my dad, when my son was born, he's like, oh, I'm glad that I finally have a grandson with the Ostland name, you know, like Missy's last name is Evans, you know, but now we've got and I'm like, Dad, you've got Curtis, who's a couple years older, but he's through the olive branch of my brother who left the church and he doesn't have the priesthood. So like my dad was thinking priesthood lineage. And I'm like, you got an Ostland grandson and like raising that to him was so offensive, you know, like he was so offended that I would call him out on that. And you know, he's like, that's not what I meant. You know what I mean? I'm like,
your dad has got to be so tormented just thinking about kids, his own kids, because
for him because he just doesn't do it anymore.
Right. But I have to think that somewhere, sometime he, when thinking about all three of his kids leaving the church, that it's like, it's his damn wife's DNA that did that. There's no way that I am a righteous elder high priest in Zion and I raise my kids well. Do you think he thinks that you guys all got mom's DNA?
No. No, I don't think
he does. We could have a whole other podcast on that.
Yeah, I don't think he really puts that much thought into it, really. Okay. He'd go to Alma and Alma the Younger before he went to anything in the real world.
Oh, yeah. Boy, Alma the Younger. Boy, was he a hellion.
Yeah. Yeah, but he turned out okay in the end.
Oh, sure did, man. Yeah. He showed Korihor what was going on. Yeah. So to bring this funeral discussion full circle, this is my own personal opinion, because I just can't
the whole
find
podcast?
No, about whether or not Mormons at funerals, is it a good thing for them to deny death and through this narrative that they have and this belief system? And this is also something that was brought up in the documentary, is that they talked about fundamentalist worldviews. They provide, and this is what they said, and one of the psychologists said in the documentary, said they provide tremendous peace when tragically one of your loved ones dies. But then they said, but that comes with some baggage. It comes with some problems. And one of the problems with fundamentalist religions is that they believe that their belief system is the one and only true way. And so even if you believe that yours is the one and only true way, not just your way and the way that's best for you, even the very existence of competing worldviews is threatening to you. They don't even have to challenge you directly. Just the very existence, if you think about them, gives you cognitive dissonance. And I think that's what's happening when someone in a Mormon family leaves. And like just saying, like when my mom was telling, when she was still alive and my brother left the church, you know, she couldn't be in the same room without crying. And she kept saying things that like, do you not believe that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God? It's like, no, Mom, I don't. And for him to say I don't isn't like disagreeing on politics. It's like threatening to her worldview and creates so much stress and trauma to her. So, yeah, I think that Mormons at funerals are happier than an atheist at a funeral. But again, it comes at a price. Was that fair, Glenn?
You're saying what you think.
You didn't attack it.
Because you were saying what you think.
Oh, so if I preface it with, this is what I think.
If you become a fundamentalist and like try and impose it on everything else, or it sounds like to me that that's what's happening, that's when I push back. If you're just saying what you think, that's cool.
Yeah, so I really do think that there is a benefit to death denial of that magnitude, a fundamentalist religion and magnitude. I think in the moment of the crisis and the tragedy, I think it's a salve.
I'm going to push back just a smidge because I can see the other side of it also, where if you are the atheist at a funeral or somebody who believes that like it's dead over, you can almost have a peace in yourself feeling like, you know, they're all kind of deluding themselves here, but I feel like I know what's really up. And I'm really dealing with it where they're not. They're putting it off. You know what I mean?
That's kind of how I felt at my cousin's funeral. I'm looking around at all the smiling faces. And I can't, obviously, I wear my emotions on my sleeve. You know, I look like it's probably red-faced, puffy eyes. And it was obvious. Like, all of my really believing cousins, word had gotten out. I know word had gotten out because I had one cousin. He's like the most successful cousin. He's a millionaire. And stake president, and you know, he's like, "Hey, Randy, why don't you ride with me to the burial site?" And then when we're in the car, he says, "You know what, Grandpa Peterson, who's our common grandpa, there was this one time when he pulled out Jesus the Christ, and he testified to me, and I swear to you, I could see the countenance of Jesus in his eyes." And I'm just like, this is such a weird conversation. I mean, it was like right out of the blue. And then some other cousins, tried to console me with, you know, this is not the end, Randy. I mean, like, almost like, relax, dude. She's fine. You know, she's in a better place. So I did have that thought, Melissa. I'm like, none of these people are dealing with what's going on. This is driving me crazy. I'm the only one mourning her.
But even if you're looking at it from that atheist point of view, couldn't you agree she's in a better place?
She's better place than she was like a week before she died.
In this world of suffering?
No, because
she's just she's in a place of absolute peace, absolute rest, no worries, no concerns, nothing.
Yeah, but
that's nice.
That's
comforting.
Because I was allowed in because I was a first cousin. I was allowed into the prayer. And to watch her 3, 5, and 7-year-old daughters give her the last kiss goodbye and have the casket shut, that ripped me apart.
See, but how much of this, and then I looked over.
Go ahead. And then my dad's standing next to me. And if you remember, my dad... Well, you don't remember, but my dad, he lost his mom when she died suddenly when he was 6. So I was like, this has got to just be tearing him apart to have to go back to 1945 and remember this. And I look over at him, and he's just as stoic as can be, kind of looking around. And I'm just like, what is wrong with you, Dad? Do you not have a heart? This is the saddest scene I've ever seen in my life.
So we've had a lot of conversations, Randy, about different brain types, you know, different personality types. I think there's probably more of that going on in this case than ascribing it all to a belief system. I mean, I think the two work together, but
that's a fair point because my dad prides himself on publicly crying 3 times in his life.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I cry, you know, almost every day.
Almost every time we talk.
All right. Are we done? Are we done?
G'day, this is Jocelyn from Australia, and I listen to Infants on Thrones when I am in the lab counting pollen for my research. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the quorum a 5-star rating, and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Those kinds of things, like in the church,
yeah,
when somebody dies,
that she can see you, that kind of thing, or
no, not even that, but like, oh, you actually have like experiences like where you feel like that person is with you and watching you, and like
your mom has had with your dead brother.
Yes, but even more so, like it's almost like it becomes, I'm thinking more of grandma. I was trying to be more gentle because I know it's special to the people who have had it. But I remember mom telling me after our grandmother passed just this last May that in the family, people kept having these experiences where she like appeared to them. And like it happened with a couple of my aunts, it happened with a couple of my cousins. And like, I guess they weren't even really wanting to tell our mom that much about like the situations at first because they didn't know where she would be with it.
They
know that she's kind of,
they didn't want to throw their pearls before swine.
Right. And maybe we can edit this out if whatever. But anyways, no, so just like, and I thought that was something in Mike's list too, of like, it validates almost that belief system that, you know, they are still there, and it's like they're with you and they're watching you and they're visiting you. And, you know, yeah, so before I couldn't have seen my grandma because she's still in Arizona and I'm in Kansas City, but when she's dead, like, she could be here with me right now, you know, watching over me, and she is.
Maybe she's a face in your couch.
Nice inside joke. I think those, like, my mom, before she had to go in for her first surgery, when she first got diagnosed, it's in her book that my dad wrote. He took it out of her journal. Her dead dad, according to her story, and she wasn't even... That's not how she tells the story. Usually these stories happen in a dream. But she says that she was reading the Book of Mormon and praying in her bed the night before the surgery. And her father visited her and held her in his arms. And so I think those kinds of stories are comforting. It's the flip side that's not so great is the thought that my mom is with me at all times, even when I'm masturbating. That's the
You're treating
the
your body like an amusement park.
Georgie!
You just need to think of something different.
Is that Craig laughing? Because it sounds like Matt.
Yeah, it was me.
Your laugh is a lot like Matt's laugh.
Okay, so that's the only other thought I had there. Looks like we've hit a dead end, alright.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.